Welcome back to the Final K Be Better podcast. Today we are again back up in the Final K Global HQ headquarters. We're actually in the second story of the Global HQ. We are also today just brilliantly gifted to be with a man that I've known for quite a long time, a friend of mine, a swim guru, I like to think of him as, Tim Walton.
Well, hi, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Tim. Thank you for being here. And, you know, as we're sitting here, as you hear Tim talk, you'll notice that he has a beautiful accent.
Well, I don't know about that, but...
Tim, today you grace us with some good tea that we're drinking.
Yes, some PG tips, good old-fashioned PG tips. Can't go wrong.
Can't go wrong. We don't have any biscuits to go with it, though.
No, you need to get some digestive biscuits, Chris. Otherwise, this might not happen again.
I'm sorry. I'll be better next time.
Okay.
I will be better. But I did. We are also drinking from a couple of Olympic mugs here today. You have the 2012 Summer Olympics from London mug that we brought back.
Yeah, it's excellent. Tea tastes great out of it.
It does. And I have the Sochi 2014 Winter Olympic mug. Now, I will start you off with a bit of trivia question. Can you name the mascot for the 2012 London Olympics? The little fella that's on there on your mug right there.
You know, I'm ashamed to say I do not know the actual name.
The little, to describe him, how would you describe that guy? How would you describe him?
Well, he looks a bit like a chicken to me, but I'm not wearing my glasses, so.
Don't have your readers on?
I don't have my readers on, unfortunately.
His name was Wenlock.
Wenlock?
Yeah, I don't have any idea about it. That was a weird name.
Wenlock.
Wenlock, and he's kind of like a cyclops. He's a cyclops because he's got only one eyeball.
Hmm.
And, yeah, interesting, huh?
Yeah, very interesting.
Well,
I don't know.
Well, you got that going for you.
Yes, it's a fantastic mug. Hope you get an opportunity to drink from one at some point.
If you can, if you have the means to, we recommend it.
Sounds good.
Tim, so one of the things that you have as an expertise and something that you have been specializing in for a while, and I know that I've gone to the well with you on, is your ability to kind of make adults swim at, I would say, probably at their optimal best, and you are a user and I would say a champion of the TI system, the total immersion system. Can you give us a little bit of background about how you came into TI and why you feel TI can benefit people and how it actually does benefit people versus just going and trying to figure out how to swim on their own?
Yeah, and total immersion has been around for many years. The founder, Terry Laughlin, who unfortunately passed away just recently, but he had always had a very clear way of explaining things, especially for, as we would call, adult onset swimmers or triathletes, very good athletes that are very well accomplished in many of their own sports, but really struggled with the swimming. So total immersion is, I came around to total immersion having seen Terry Laughlin at some of the World Swimming Coaches clinics. He would come in and talk about an alternative way to swim. And it really, it's not so much that it's an alternative way to swim, but it's just nicely presented. The materials are good. The progressions are very clear. And tends to be a less intimidating way of presenting swimming to athletes. So,
if you're an adult trying to find more about TI or trying to figure out how do I get involved with a TI coach or a TI clinic, what are some of the avenues that they can go to? Obviously, probably I'm guessing a Google search would be a great first start.
TotalImmersion.net is a great resource, and on that site you can see clinics and workshops listed, and a lot of the professionals who are certified Total Immersion coaches, that you can find those resources through the TotalImmersion.net website. I'm in Minneapolis at the Uptown YWCA and the Downtown YWCA. We do a lot of swimming workshops there. So there's an affiliation through YWCA in Minneapolis area, but there are coaches all over the world and in different states. I personally do a lot of about one per month here in Minneapolis, and usually one per month maybe in San Francisco or in Palm Desert. There's a lot, and I like going there in the winter because it gets us away from the cold and the snow. So
absolutely. Take me back to kind of the thoughts around in your head when you first came into TI, because you were a swim coach before and you had been involved with coaching swimmers at a number of different levels. When you first saw it, what were some of the things that you said, "Wow, this is really what I've been trying to articulate, but haven't"? Or was there something that really grasped you initially?
Yes. Well, you know, you mentioned that I have worked with a lot of different athletes. I've worked with complete beginners all the way up to Olympic trial qualifiers. So I have had a lot of experience working with different swimmers in the competitive swimming environment. I also had a lot of triathletes coming to me, and for them it was more about efficiency. And with efficiency and speed, total immersion, that's what they're all about. So total immersion is based on the foundation of three things: balance, streamline, and propulsion. In that order, very specifically in that order. So all of the progressions and the drills and the sort of the order goes starting with balance. And in all levels, even I've coached very high level swimmers who are not in balance when they swim. And so just showing them how to do that, how to redistribute their weight in the water and how to gain balance. Because if you don't have balance, or if a lot of times then a lot of compensations occur, people overkick, which isn't good if you're doing open water or if you're in triathlon and you're trying to save your legs. So the platform is really based on balance, and then streamlining the vessel. And then thirdly, you talk about propelling that vessel. And so very much the sort of find the shape of your vessel and the balance of it and then drive it.
Gotcha. And so this is something that even if an individual or let's say an age group triathlete who found themselves to be what they consider a competent swimmer can still find benefit in, whereas there are probably some flaws that they may not have been able to recognize or see, and that they would still find benefit in isolating what those are and how they can correct those.
Yep, absolutely. This morning I had several clients, and one of them sort of came to me. He's looking to do an open water swim in Ireland next summer, and it was talking about how he was overstroking. He was over 20 strokes per length, which for someone who's 6 feet tall is too many.
Wow.
And so this morning I took a video of him and played it directly back to him, and it showed that his feet were dorsiflexed or pointing down and not pointing back enough. And so he was basically creating an anchor, and he was sinking with his feet and overkicking.
Okay.
So that was an example of telling him to turn the kick down, point his toes, turn them slightly inward, and create a nice propelling surface as opposed to a sort of an overcompensation. So there are a lot of things you can address with an athlete that they might be very athletic, they might be very smart, and they might do very well in other sports, but having them understand some of the most basic things, such as a two-beat kick. Going back to Total Immersion definitely promotes the ability to have a two-beat kick. You can do a four or a six-beat kick in different applications, but if you can learn how to have a well-timed two-beat kick, you can choose to use it or not.
Okay. And just so our listeners understand what a 2B kick is, can you describe how, I know what it is, but can you describe in your words what a 2B kick is versus
that's one kick per stroke or one per arm. Okay. So let's say, for example, that you put your, as your right arm is entering the water, a flick from the left foot, kind of diagonally, which assists in the rotation, which allows good natural movement shift from one edge to the other.
Okay. And you, would you say the 2B kick is important, especially in distance swimmers, because it allows the conservation of energy, especially during long periods, versus a 6, 8, even a higher B kick that were a flutter kick that some athletes might do. Would you say it's harder to teach a 2B kick than it is a 6 or a 4, or do they all kind of fold in your view?
Well, it's when you kick rather than how much you kick. So even within a 6-beat kick, two of those kicks are rotational kicks. So when you bring it back to its simplest form, a 2-beat kick is the minimum amount of kick that you would want to do with the most effect, because a kick can do three things for you. It can help you balance, it can assist in rotation, and it can propel. And so what a lot of people have is the ability to propel by just kicking a lot. So okay. They have that, but then they won't have the benefit of a well-timed, that two of those kicks are not rotating them, or they're kicking busily, because otherwise if they didn't kick, their feet would sink.
Yes.
I don't know if I've used the word busily for a long time. Like very busy.
Busily?
Busily. Okay. I don't know if I heard of.
Is that like hugely?
Hugely. Bigly.
Bigly.
I know. I was thinking about finding that.
It was close.
So we do have, but a lot of people, they overkick versus the benefits of doing so. So a lot of times people will kick at a high tempo, but they're really not getting anything from that. And that's exhausting. You know, your legs are definitely propellers, or your feet are, but you certainly can burn off a lot of energy with a little return. So keeping a small or compact kick that you can manage as a 2-beat if you'd like is definitely something we talk about a lot in total immersion, for sure.
Is there a way that you see more often people being inefficient with their kick, meaning the not the number so much, but the style? And I speak to witnessing a lot of other swimmers in the past and seeing how I would say that they kick from the ankle with a straight leg with not a lot of velocity that's kind of come from that, and trying to draw them back to more driving from the hip, leading with the knee. Is that something that you teach as well, that you've seen, or is that something that I just kind of made up and said in BS?
No. So I'm sure, Chris, you've used this in a lot of the analogies of a lot of sports that you coach, but the one thing is to know what the root cause of it is. Like, a lot of people kick in a busy fashion because they're out of balance. So the issue might be that someone is kicking too much and getting exhausted, and it could be some technical points in there, but a lot of times it could be because they're not patient enough with their lead arm, or their head is elevated slightly, or every time that they take a breath, they slightly raise the head up, which is driving the hips down, which then causes the feet to try to kick. So, you know, as far as if you can show someone how to be balanced in the water without kicking, then when they do kick, that's just a bonus.
Okay.
They're not kicking just to keep themselves up.
And that's why balance is that primary piece in TI. That's that number one thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, these are not ideas that are unique to TI. That's just the way that it's presented and the order of which it's presented. So, you know, when I first got involved in total immersion, it was because I felt like I was already talking about these things anyway. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to be involved as a coach because it gave me a bigger outreach as far as when you go to a workshop, people are coming to a workshop not specifically for you. They're going to learn the total immersion method, and then the bonus is that they get you if it goes well.
I always like to think of it the other way, but you know, that's just me.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's people find it very beneficial because they feel like they get much better use of their energy. To realize that you don't actually have to try harder in order to go faster is very appealing to some people. But if you have a lot of athletes who have a type A personality that feel like, I can train harder if you want me to, and I can and try harder if you'd like me to, but a lot of times it's not so much about how much more speed can you get, but it's more about protecting the speed you have and not letting it go away. And so instead of trying harder, you do more with what you're already doing.
Yeah. And I think in triathlon that becomes really important too, because you see a lot of people that just basically become completely exhausted in the swim.
Yes.
And there's nothing left for the rest of the race, whereas they want to be able to swim with and having still some in the tank, being able to be as conservative as possible, but still maximizing as much velocity as they can take out of that.
Absolutely. And, you know, certainly depending on the athlete and what their goals and objectives, you might have an athlete that comes to you and tells you that, I just can't swim straight. I just keep pulling off to the left or to the right. And within, 100 strokes, I'm 20, 30 yards off course. It's very common. There's ways that you can help someone in the pool with that, such as in a safe environment, you could have them swim with their eyes closed for 4 strokes. If they pull to the left, you know that there's an issue. Well, they know because they get that feedback. It's alternatively to the right. But so encouraging, Chris, you've seen this probably in a lot of the lessons that you've done, is that people do tend to overreach the midline.
Yep.
And if you overreach the midline and you cross over, you're sending your energy in a direction you don't want to. Now, your eyes and your brain, you're very smart. You then compensate by doing something on the other side, which allows you to swim straight. In a pool, you're using your eyes to swim straight. You're not necessarily using your stroke to Absolutely. Swim straight. So,
and that you don't have that in a lake. You don't have that little black line to follow.
So when you're working with triathletes in a pool who present you saying, I have that issue that I never can stay on course, it's usually because of either an overreaching or being off balance.
Okay.
And, just telling someone to close their eyes and swim just sort of highlights that they can see, oh, wow, I would, if I were in a lake and I couldn't see where I was going, that's what would happen.
Yeah, they tack like a sailboat a lot of times. Yeah. They just kind of go back and forth. A lot of times I've used the analogy of you have to almost swim like a tank, whereas a tank can only go straight when both tracks are going in the same direction at the same speed.
Yeah.
If one's going differently, then the tank will veer off one way or the other.
That's a good analogy. I might use that.
You know, it's patented.
Is it patented?
It's patented. Well, right, I think it's trademarked, actually.
I'll throw one back at you. We use the 3-lane highway.
Oh?
So we think your head is one lane down the middle, and your right arm is the right lane, left arm the left lane. And at no point should any of them go into the other one's lane. And
it's
so
true.
3-lane highway. And the shortest distance between two points, obviously, we want to draw the line, hold the line, drive the line. We talk about that.
Yeah.
It's kind of, it's not per se TI terminology, but a lot of TI coaches are using that. Actually, that last one is the finding the line, draw the line, drive the line is a TI reference on a presentation. So
that is trademarked. That is patented. That's can't steal that one.
I'm not sure, to be honest with you. It's on my presentations that I've...
I'll claim ignorance if I ever do it, though. So I want to ask your opinion on something. So, and I do coaching and education for USA Triathlon for level ones and level twos for coaches. And in a lot of the swim presentations, and I've gotten into some conversations with some pretty high level, they were Olympic swimmers, and some Olympic coaches that are on both sides of this. In the recovery stroke, my position is on a recovery that I believe that the recovery is most effective with a high elbow, low hanging hand close to the body, and promoting even body rotation and also enabling for a more efficient and effective straight level hand entry, meaning the hand enters halfway between the nose and the full extension point and can extend straight forward. The counterpoint that I've been argued against on that is the straight arm, what I've call the tomahawk chop entry as another more efficient way to have a recovery. I've made my case on one side, and I've you know, kind of been back and forth. I'm interested to know what your position on that might be and why.
Well, just that kind of thing, if you take it to the extreme, then there can be benefits to both ways on that, particularly in competitive swimming with some of the stronger athletes. You will see a lot of that tomahawk chop that you call in the last 10 meters of a race, where they're going all out, everything, giving everything. They're going to be done in about 5 seconds, and they throw it because they feel they can get a lot more momentum. A lot more momentum is generated by throwing the arms in a straight way and that tomahawk chop. So it is used in competitive swimming in certain situations and in certain events. I would say particularly in the longer events, longer open water events, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me because there's a lot of distance traveled by tomahawk chopping. There's a lot of direct stress onto the shoulder, which a lot of people can't really control. And that's not a big fan of it, just purely because a lot of times then when the hand goes in, it's going in a sloppy way and you're not driving towards your target. Alternatively, the high elbow position can be misinterpreted and it can be overdone also. If your hand gets too close to your body, what ends up happening is that you see some people start to get a hand lead because there's no motion in the shoulder. So my take on it is that you want, during the recovery, to keep the elbow on the scapula plane such that it's a nice, easy path that your shoulder is very happy to do, and that you're not creating torque in your shoulders by swimming with a straight arm. Of course, with both of these ways, you know, it will work for some and not for others. Mm-hmm. So I would say it is somewhat of a case-by-case, athlete-by-athlete kind of way. I tend to favor more of the high elbow, but not getting too close. As long as that at the midpoint of the recovery, in my opinion, if you have a 90-degree angle on your elbow or equal triangle shape at the midpoint of recovery, then that is about the width of that of recovery. If you get what I call chicken wing, I'm bending my elbow. If you get too sharp of an isosceles kind of shape, then it tends to promote a hand lead because there's no way the shoulder can release at that point.
Yeah.
So I'd say I'm a little physics based on that one and biomechanics. But certainly I've seen people swim with straight arms quite effectively. A lot of times it's the higher level athletes that have got an incredible motor on them anyway. So I don't know if it's because of their stroke that they're successful or it's because they're heart and lungs.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, that's the hard part. I don't know that there's a straight right answer. And you know, like as you pointed out, and I've seen it even with para athletes, where I was working with a paraplegic male at the Olympic Training Center a couple weeks back, and he had just voiced his opinion about how he needed to do a straight arm recovery. And how it just needed to come all the way around. That was his only way to rotate his body.
What class was he in?
I don't know what his PT is, but he was a wheelchair bound. So okay. He has no use of his, from the waist down, no use of his legs. But he still has his legs there. So he was, I don't know if that'd be PT1? PTS1?
Hmm.
I'm just new into para, so my classification knowledge is not great there. He was just out of just coming off a long block where he had a recent surgery where he couldn't be in the pool,
yeah.
And so he was just kind of retooling where his arm stroke was, and we were working with that. And he had basically said, "I need to have the straight arm recovery, otherwise I can't really rotate my body around."
I can totally agree with that because, you know, obviously, one of the things when we talked about the recovery, a lot has to do with what's happening in your core and with the kick. in combination with that. And so obviously if he had did not have the use of his legs, how else is he going to generate that timing and have that propulsion or lack of propulsion there? So
yeah.
he only time he can propel is with his arms, and so the sooner his arms get there, the better.
Yeah, and it worked. I mean, it was amazing to see. We videoed him before and after, and it was it really did work. As like he moved visually faster in the pool, he was much smoother. Now we also helped with some timing in the front quadrant as well, because he was getting into a little bit of a windmill, and so we kind of threw a little bit of three-quarter catch up in there just to kind of correct his tweak his timing just for a second. But the straight arm really allowed him to, and he was a bigger guy. So he was a Golden Knight. He was in the Army. He jumped out of airplanes, and he was the, you know, one of those, he was like one of the elite parachutists in the Army. And, so he's a big fella. I mean, this guy kick your butt. He'd kick both of our butts right now. You know, that's not saying much, but you know, but he had a lot to move around. But that straight arm did generate a lot of movement to allow him to be more balanced and rotating.
Yeah, certainly. And so, it very much depends on the athlete as to how you go. We have on the age group swim team that both of my daughters swim on, the Minneapolis Otters, we have an athlete that just got back from the World Championship Para Games, Natalie Sims. She's been with the program for many years. She's off to college now. But she just got back, and she is in the S9 category, where just below her elbow, so her elbow works, but just below her, that's where her arm ends. And so
okay.
Talking about different athletes, different needs, she is able to swim, I think, a 57 or 58 seconds in 100 freestyle with basically... only propelling from kick and from her left arm. But
wow.
Obviously when you have an imbalance in propulsive opportunity, then she has really become quite good at propelling off an arm. She calls it spike. I didn't call it that. She called it a spike, but you know, she gets a lot of propulsion off a very small area. And mm-hmm. so if you've ever tried swimming with your fist closed, then you'll get a new appreciation for what your hand actually can do. Yes. And if you try swimming with one hand with your fist closed and the other one open, you'll see there's a lot of, it's amazing how the brain can adjust and still be able to get good propulsion without her swimming off course.
Well, the human body is amazing in its ability to adapt and overcome. If you think about it, it's, you know, this, all the things that that I've witnessed in the para realm. I mean, you have archers that use only their feet.
Yeah.
And I mean, just every when you think you've seen it all, somebody comes along and does something just a little bit more amazing. And so I'm excited to be starting to work with the para triathlon national team more, and that's becoming more of an exciting piece to just get to know more people and to see some of the great individuals out there that are really pushing some of the, I would say, boundaries of possibilities and capabilities, and I think changing people's minds and doing some things that I had never seen before, which are exciting.
Truly inspirational too. And you know, I think for a lot of younger athletes who are have the function of all of their body, it's a good reminder for them not to take it for granted and to also optimize their abilities too.
And stop whining.
Yeah. Stop whining.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, you know, today is the opening ceremonies of the Phnom Chang Winter Olympics. And, it's hard because for me, 4 years ago, I was in Sochi and got to, experience the Winter Olympics in person, my first ones, which was amazing. But as a Summer Olympics sports guy, are there still events in the Winter Olympics for you that get you jazzed up? Or, I mean, will you be sitting down with your family and watching the opening ceremonies tonight?
Yes, but we were sitting down yesterday to watch the opening ceremonies, but we were one day too early. So we were all excited sitting in front of the TV, but then it said, coming tomorrow.
Oh, but there were events last night, though.
There were, and we did watch, and we saw some of the skating and how some of the athletes struggled. So it'll be interesting to see how they recover from that. So figure skating is, for me, I actually heard John Oliver say something like this last night too, is I find that anything that's judged or by judges as opposed to time or place, I find really difficult to watch. It's quite stressful, like all the deductions and the points and the judges and the fairness of the scoring. And it's kind of fascinating with skating. But as far as the sports that I'm kind of interested in watching, I like when they all get on the snowboards and race down like four or five of them at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
Those are, for me, I find those exciting.
Snowcross.
And now that my wife bought me skis, cross-country skis for Christmas, so I'm now interested in the classic skiing and the skate skiing, and so we'll be watching for some of that too.
Those Nordic events are awesome. I'm interested to see how the hockey games fold out this year, because this year the NHL players will not be playing. So the NHL had voted to not allow their players to go participate this year.
Why was that?
It's injuries, it's distractions, it was loss of revenue. So imagine taking all the best players off of the teams just randomly and sending them to an event, and then you might get your guy back. And some teams lost some, you know, their best players, which then financially impacts them later on, because they get no financial compensation for sending and letting their players go. And that's during the season. And it's not just for like for the 2 weeks of the games. It's like has to be, you know, leading up to and all the preparation for. So you're losing some of your top players for.
Does that make for a more level playing field, though? Like
in the Olympics?
Sense, yeah, like you're sending. Because I imagine there are a lot of the top U.S. college players. Is it the same for them, too? Are colleges resenting sending their college players?
I think you're going to see more of the European players that are over there now that aren't playing in the NHL. So you're seeing some of the Tier 2 Canadian, you know, juniors that are going over. You're seeing some of the, you know, the U.S. Collegiate players going over as well.
Kind of more of the spirit of the Olympics, though, in some ways.
Is the idea to try to get back to the, you know, the Miracle on Ice 1980s, you know, team that was just, you know, the ragtag group of boys that went and beat the big, you know, big red machine. I think that's probably kind of the mystical idea of what can happen. I don't know that that's what will happen, because the Russian team is not like that anymore. You know, don't have the Soviet Union. You know, it's not the Soviets anymore.
I thought that a lot of the athletes were banned.
Many of them were, but then the IOC last week changed. They switched it around for, I think, 24 athletes were allowed that were appealed and were allowed to get in, but they cannot actually compete under the Russian flag. If you watched last night, they're under the Olympic flag.
OAR, yeah.
Yeah, which is a band out there. OAR is a band. If you go back a couple years ago, they had one singular hit, and I'm like, wow, they're there, and it's not them. But they are like in the blank uniforms. You know, I think when they're racing.
Is it the whole team then? Because, I mean, how many players do you have to have on a squad?
I don't think it's – I think it becomes this kind of like – like foster family, you know, it's like a catch-all for whoever wants to, because it doesn't necessarily have to be the Russians. It could be, you know, you could be from, I'm not saying the Jamaican bobsled team would be part of that, but if your country can't field a whole team and you're just as an individual and you are not representing your country, or for some reason your country didn't go, then you come under that. Or if you are switching nationalities, like you used to be a British national citizen, but now you are in transition to be an American citizen. If the rules are stay with me, I believe there is 1 year you have to transition to be as a neutral athlete. So you compete in one Olympiad as a British national athlete, then you as a next Olympiad as a neutral athlete, then the next one you can go as an American.
I think that's kind of interesting. Like, and I think the spirit of that rule is probably to stop people from suddenly making a squad complete by suddenly switching their allegiance and
or buying off a bunch of athletes.
Yeah,
you know, because otherwise Australia would have purchased New Zealand. You know, they'd have bought them all.
Well, in swimming, you know, if you choose to switch teams, in a USA swimming team,
mm-hmm.
then you have to become unattached for, I think it's maybe 120 days. It used to be 90 days, but it's kind of the spirit of it is such that you don't want necessarily someone switching to another team to fill out their roster on a national qualifying relay or something.
Yeah.
But it sort of discourages people to not just jump around.
I think that's kind of the same thing that's going on here. So
yeah,
it should be interesting though. But those, I think it's going to be a good Olympiad. Hopefully, there's nothing goofy that's going to happen. I mean, it is, you know, the whole North Korean, South Korean thing going on too.
Well, they seem to be getting along just fine last night, right? Is that what they were reporting?
I saw handshakes.
Yeah,
I saw handshakes, and was it Kim Jong-un's sister's there?
Oh.
She's there as a representative. So, hey, it's better than the alternative, right?
Anytime people reach out to make things better, then I'm up for that.
Just, you know, hugs, not drugs. Well, Tim, we've kind of reached the end of our time here, but I can't thank you enough for coming over to the Playhouse and bringing some amazing tea. And enjoy the Olympics, and best of luck with TI. And maybe I'll come out and learn a couple things here in my rehab sessions and get some tips from you.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
All right, everybody. Thank you for spending another quality bit of time with us, and hopefully this will help make you better. Until you came around, the silence seems so